Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker Studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Thursday, May 28th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman here.
You couldn't see Avi, but he did a little shoulder bop. I did a shoulder bop. He did a shoulder bop.
Oh, my God.
It's Thursday.
We had a reset. Welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Welcome to the program, friends. I'm Cherry Gregg. So, over the past year, Avi and I have spent a lot of time exploring the American Revolution through our Tavern 250 tour. We talked about the battles, the founding fathers, the declarations, and the debates that shaped the country. But the closer we get to America's 250th anniversary, the more urgent another question becomes: whose stories have been left out of the founding narrative? A new PBS documentary, Becoming American: Philadelphia's Story, shifts the focus toward Black Philadelphians and communities of color whose fight for freedom extended far beyond independence from Britain. The film explores Philadelphia not just as the birthplace of democracy, but also as a place where slavery, resistance, abolition, faith, and activism all collided. So I enjoyed this film. It premieres tonight at 8 on WHYY TV 12. And today we'll play a recording of my conversation with the filmmakers behind Becoming American: Philadelphia's Story. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to that. I wasn't part of the conversation, so yeah. I'm going to get to hear it for the first time. I'm going to get to live that experience with the rest of the listeners. So that'll be interesting and fun for me. It's also Thursday,
which means DJ of the day, which is why we were shoulder bopping a little bit.
Is that why? I didn't know why I was shoulder bopping.
Trying to give us a reason.
Just trying to give us some cover? Yes. Got it. Okay, so it is DJ of the day. We end the show every week with a song picked by one of you on the topic of that day's show. We've decided, I guess we're looking for a song today that sort of means America to you.
Becoming American.
Becoming American.
Born in America, something.
Yeah, yeah. Ultimately, EP Kevin will pick the winner, and we will shout you out at the end of the show if you are our DJ of the day. If you want to participate, if you want to make a suggestion, email it to studio2@whyy.org before 12:30. That's DJ of the day.
Yeah, I think we'll get some good ones, I predict.
Yes, it's a rich topic. It is.
Yeah, there's a lot of things you can... I thought of a few just immediately.
Just now.
So, yeah. So anyway,
do you want to share any or
no? I want to hear what the audience
Fair
has
enough.
To say.
And okay, EP, first, a trio of local news stories, let's start with a story that touches both sides of the river. Apparently, yesterday was data center proposal day in the Delaware Valley. No one told us because the governors of Pennsylvania and New Jersey each independently unveiled plans that would change the rules for data center developers on the same day. I don't think it was coordinated.
No.
It just happened. So let's start in New Jersey, where Mikey Sherrill announced a four-prong plan. It would require data center developers to cover the cost of electricity that they use by bringing their own energy to the grid. Mm-hmm. They would also have to report on their power and water consumption. They would have to address noise and pollution concerns with local communities, and they would need to build facilities with union labor at a certain wage scale. That's the New Jersey proposal, not passed yet. Now over to Pennsylvania and Governor Josh Shapiro. His plan is a little bit more carrot than stick. It would take tax and permitting incentives already proposed for data center development and make them contingent on meeting certain criteria. So to get these incentives, if this plan were to pass, developers would need to show and do something pretty similar to what New Jersey is thinking about. They'd have to have a community outreach plan. They'd have to show how they'll provide their own energy and transition to clean energy. They'd have to reduce water consumption and commit to a certain level of worker pay. So they're kind of similar plans, but they're structured differently. One would be like a set of rules in New Jersey. The other would be like check boxes you'd have to check to get incentives in Pennsylvania. And all of this at this stage, just proposals.
Yeah. This is fast becoming an even bigger issue for people on all sides of the aisle, in part because everything's moving so fast with these data centers. And I want to just point out, on Wednesday night, residents showed up and showed out at the Upper Marion Planning Commission meeting. Yep. It was standing room only. People in the overflow room, they were in the lobby all waiting to speak. And the overall sentiment was not in my backyard. So you have citizens from Delaware. You have them from all over Pennsylvania,
well,
New Jersey.
Vineland, New Jersey.
Oh,
recently.
My goodness. Yeah. So that's why I think the governors and the lawmakers feel like they have to step up and do something, because people are, they're not playing with this. Yeah. This is coming into communities. At the same time, you have governors like Josh Shapiro saying, AI, we want to be the new hub.
Right.
And so there needs to be a referee in the middle figuring this thing out and doing it quickly.
Yeah. And you mentioned those community meetings.
Yeah.
And regardless of whatever happens at the state level, there's still going to be grassroots resistance.
Oh, yeah.
Because you need, you know, zoning permits and variations often to build these data centers. And so that means going to the local community and asking for permission. And that's really where the rubber meets the road, regardless of what the state wants to do around its guardrails.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. We'll be watching that. And of course, we'll probably be talking about data centers again, because this issue keeps bubbling.
Speaking of local elections and resistance, go ahead.
Yeah. A Delaware judge ruled this week that corporations are allowed to vote in local elections in a Delaware town. This ruling stems from a dispute in the sleepy beach town of Fenwick Island, Delaware. The town has a law that allows corporations and other entities to vote in its municipal elections. Now, the ACLU of Delaware sued, arguing that the law violated the elections clause of the state's constitution, and they asked the court to block non-human artificial entities from participating in future elections. Hmm. But the court held that companies that own property in that town could vote. And this ruling stands out because corporations make up about 12% of registered voters on Fenwick Island. So they could be pretty influential if they voted as a block there and work together. Now, the mayor of that town told Reuters back in March that a property owner who pays taxes and is subject to our ordinances should have a say in who represents them on our town council. And now this whole issue, Avi, centers on a small town.
Right.
But, you know, it does rile people up, because this issue of non-human entities, it touches a nerve, because
In Delaware,
because over 2 million businesses are registered in Delaware, right? That's more than nearly double the number of people living in the state. So if this was statewide,
right,
these non-resident entities could have total sway over the people. But right now it's just limited to Fenwick Island.
Yeah, and I can't imagine, like, a lot of them are incorporated in Wilmington, in Newcastle County. I can't imagine a town there doing this, because they would be worried about exactly that. So I can't imagine the people of Wilmington saying, yes, we want, just name your, you know, multinational corporation having a say in our municipal elections. This is a slightly different case, because you're talking about a beach town with very few year-round residents, and there's lots of business owners, sometimes small business owners, who the fate of the town and the fate of their businesses are very much bound up in each other, and there's some reason for them to want to have a say in local matters. But it would obviously be a very different story if you did it in a place where a lot of these multinationals are registered.
And I do want to point out that in 2023, the state legislature tried to pass a law that would expand the charter in Seaford, Delaware,
right,
to allow corporations to vote. But that was struck down by the Senate. And they said, look, we love businesses in Delaware, but that's a bridge too far.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. And obviously, Delaware has a very different constitution than other states, and a very different relationship with corporations than many states as well.
But
so Delaware's a little bit of a...
people looking at those non-humans like,
yes,
what's going on over there?
And so it sort of, in a way, cross sections with this debate over whether corporations are people when it comes to, like, campaign donations, had been a big... Right. So I can see why. This is an issue that touches a nerve for a lot of people.
Bubbling up. So third story.
Third story here. So if you were to go around the country and ask people about soft pretzels, a lot of people, their reference point would be Super Pretzel.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what I'm talking about, you almost certainly have seen it. A Super Pretzel, it's that red and yellow logo.
Mm-hmm.
They're often at ballparks, amusement parks, etc.
Delicious.
I had actually always assumed that Super Pretzels were not from Philly, but I was wrong. The man behind Super Pretzel's success was Gerald Schreiber, who just passed away at age 84. According to the Philadelphia Business Journal, Schreiber bought a local Philly pretzel company in 1971 that had 8 employees and was in bankruptcy. And he eventually turned that company into a snack empire that includes Super Pretzel, but also Icy, frozen beverages.
Yeah.
You know, them,
another,
the red
more
and blue.
Deliciousness. Yeah.
Dippin' Dots and many, many more favorites. The parent company apparently is still based in South Jersey. I had no idea, first of all, that all these, basically everything that you could get at a ballpark is under the umbrella of this company in South Jersey.
Yeah.
And that Super Pretzel has local roots. I just did not know that. Sadly, it took this man's passing for me to realize this, but it sounds like a pretty amazing sort of business success story from South Jersey.
Yeah, rest in peace to Gerald Schreiber. And really cool story. He owned Whole Fruit, you know, the frozen fruit pops.
Yes,
love those.
Yes.
And the funnel cake factory. You got to have a funnel cake when you go to Carnival.
It's like a niche market. It's like a specific type of snack that you get a specific type of place, like a ballpark or an amusement park. But apparently they're all kind of like made by this one company.
Yeah, really cool. He was also a philanthropist. He donated millions to help for the care of animals.
Yes.
$30 million to Rowan's first veterinary school. And yeah, so he's done a lot in the community. And, you know, rest in peace.
By the way, shout out to Pretzel Day Pretzels,
ooh,
which is in South Philly. Tried them for the first time this weekend. Might be the best soft pretzel I've had in all of Philly.
That's a lot. You know what, Avi? You are good on the food.
Yeah.
I got to go down
it's
there.
It's right up there
it
with
out.
Miller's Twist.
Okay.
So for our YouTube folks, we are signing off for now because we're going to go to a recorded conversation on the other side of this break. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere, radio folks. We've got more great stuff coming.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The founding fathers, the speeches, the battles, and the documents that shaped the nation. As we get closer to the 250th anniversary of our country's founding, these stories, names, and faces are everywhere. But there is also important history to be told about the people who were fighting for freedom while being denied freedom themselves.
A documentary premiering tonight on TV 12 explores history through the lens of communities of color right here in Philadelphia. It begins with the arrival of the Isabella, the first ship carrying enslaved Africans to the Port of Philadelphia's Old London Coffee House. The filmmakers take us to the Arch Street Meeting House, where Quakers debated abolition, and to Mother Bethel AME, a church founded by a freed black man.
Philly is not just the birthplace of American democracy. It's a city where people pushed back against the laws and systems that marginalized and dehumanized them. It was also home to the largest free and literate group of black people in the entire British Empire.
The film we're talking about is called Becoming American, Philadelphia's Story. And it dives into all of this, all of the pain and struggle, the community and connection. It was the idea of Oliver St. Clair Franklin, and he brought it to life with co-executive producer Annie Connolly.
The bulk of today's show is Cherry's recent conversation with Oliver and Annie about the stories in the film, which you can catch tonight at 8 on WHYY.
This project truly was Oliver's conception, decades in the making. He moved here in the 70s when America was celebrating an earlier birthday.
I had just arrived in Philadelphia for the bicentennial, and I was rather excited about it until I realized that most African Americans didn't emotionally connect with the bicentennial. And I tried to think about why that was, since most descendants of Africans in America have been here since 1740, when it was British North America. And I decided that if I was around in 50 years for, you know, our semi-quincentennial, our 250th, I tried to do something to address that gap. I didn't know what it was. And then I was in a film with Oxford University about the slave trade, and I met Annie and her team. And as I saw them work, I knew, aha, I can make a film.
Philadelphia, a vibrant cultural center, a modern high-rise glass metropolis, with 2.5 centuries of American stories around every corner.
I wanted to make a film about the black community in Philadelphia during the founding era. I wanted it to be historically correct. I wanted it to be visually stunning and beautiful. And I love the fact that they were British. So it's a double entendre of having a British do a film for our 250th, which was a big laugh amongst us. But the fact that they were British, they brought an outsider's view to their perspective.
I want to sort of go to, you know, your thought process, because a lot of people, when they tell stories about the founding of America, it's based in this mythology, right? That, you know, these people came together. They had these ideals about democracy, about freedom. And you wanted to push past that. Can you talk about that intention?
And the reason we could do it is because 50 years ago, the scholarship wasn't there. What we do is the scholars are really uncovering this history.
Yeah.
They're writing beautiful works. But when they finish their book and go on their book tour, the next question is, what are you doing next? They move on. Our job was to take what the scholars have done and make it visual.
Yeah.
To really tell it to the people. And what you're able to do is close this gap. You see, if you don't know, you can't remember. And if you can't remember, you have no history. And so our job was to tell people, African Americans, but all people, these people were real. They had real lives. They had battles they fought. They pulled together. They existed. They survived. They had joy, right? And we wanted to bring the human dimension to this group of people from the 1790s. And in doing that, bring it to a level that a person with a PhD and a person with a GED
could understand,
process, and really appreciate.
Yeah, Annie, I want to bring you into the conversation, because part of the problem when you create a historical documentary is that many times your image challenged, you know, especially when you are talking about a community that for the large part was kept out or left out of traditional history books. And so how did you sort of decide, okay, I'm going to take on this challenge? And how did you deal with some of the challenges that are just present in any type of historical documentary?
Yeah, there's a lot of answers I could say there. The first thing is, this is all about untold stories. So actually, it's untold and told stories mixed in together, because communities don't exist in silos.
Yeah.
You know, the elite don't exist in silos, nor do the working class, nor do that race of people or that group of people over there. The point is, this was a small town and they were all mixed together. And actually, you have an absolutely incredible resource in this city of archives. So in the archives, with the help of some of the scholars' books, and their, you know, at the end of a scholar's books, they write their reference points.
Those pages and pages.
So I read them. I went and looked. And also with the help of the institutions here, because it's such a rich resource here, then the archivists and the curators and the scholars, they helped point us in that direction too, because some of it hasn't been digitized yet. You know, we had to go hunting. So that was the first thing. You've got to go looking for the archives, because it is there. The whole perspective is not necessarily what you see immediately in the archives, but to think about community and people interacting and three-dimensional lives of ordinary people, as well as the names we are familiar with. And so what you've got to try and do as filmmakers is sort of get under the skin of it. I know that's a double metaphor, but that is literally what we did. And try to do something which one of our scholars talked about, interiority, where you, and I had to understand what that word meant, where you're thinking about what it was like to live in those times, in that complexity, with not only the issues that are pressing down upon you, whether you have to send your children into servitude or whether you are still enslaved or whether you're going to go to the court and fight for your freedom or whether you're actually going to learn a trade as an apprentice. So you're thinking about the forefront things, but you're also thinking these people were hungry or poor or rich or trying to survive, or trying to find citizenship, or trying to find out what it was to be black in America, or their neighbor was Irish, and they may have been fighting for a job. So you're trying to think about, oh, you might fall in love, and you might get pregnant, or you might apply for a marriage license at Mother Bethel.
So you create this three-dimensional person.
Or people or communities, I think. Yeah. Some individuals were there in the archives, and so we literally drew upon them. We used an artist to bring the streets of Philadelphia to life. And that's only one technique we employed. We used lots of techniques. And we've done this before as a production company, where we try to illustrate, literally illustrate, so that we're not just working off what people think are dusty old archives. I love archives. I think they're fascinating. But you've got to bring them to life. So we literally pulled them into a three-dimensional paper set, and it creates almost a hologram, and we filmed that.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how we, you asked about how do we bring it to life? How do we just not get stuck in the archives?
And you didn't just zoom in on a map and zoom out on a map, which does happen in some historical documentaries. You were able to create these three-dimensional illustrations and use those very effectively, I think, to bring a lot of people or communities to life.
Exactly. And we also, even if we had a beautiful digitized old map or grid system or lithograph or print, which we love. I love those. You know, they tell you so much, particularly William Birch and his prints, which are all over the city, which were an inspiration for the art, actually. There is art running throughout this theme from then to now. That's the whole point. We're moving between then and now editorially and visually and creatively. And when we look at those illustrations, we also got the animator to digitally move those old maps. So when you watch it in the film, you see just a little edge of movement, and that keeps the eye interested. It keeps the viewer engaged. We didn't just take the illustration. We wanted to create a sense of life in it. So nothing is just set.
The Declaration in 1776 is the end of a story that we take it as a beginning. This was the end of a long debate between folks who wanted the end point of the struggle against Great Britain to be independence versus those who didn't.
We just listen. Because if you don't do that and you're not listening to your experts, then it's hopeless. Because then you're sort of filling in the dots with made-up stuff, and I refuse to do that.
Yeah, because you're a journalist by trade.
I'm a broadcast journalist by trade. I've sat where you've sat. I get it. I've worked in television news. And actually, if the facts don't lead you, then it becomes a story, not a narrative.
And so I want to get to some of the facts, because one of the starting points of the film was with the arrival of Black people as enslaved individuals. The first slave ship, Oliver, the Isabella, arrived in Philadelphia. Tell us a bit of that story, 1684.
Well, the ship came up from the west coast of Africa, dropped people off in Jamaica, and was working its way to the docks of Philadelphia. We're not certain exactly where most came from, but we think most of the people came from what would be present-day Ghana, along the coast, along Senegal. And what the team has done, which I think brilliantly, is give you a feeling for the horror of people leaving that ship. And what our paper artist did, which I think was really interesting, and we sort of go into it, she gets the negative space of the first person stepping off the ship before they land. Before that foot comes down in America, it's about 4 inches. We call that the negative space. So we try to capture that, because once she lands, it's over in many ways for that enslaved person.
You can imagine a woman who has their young child. They're up on the sail block. There's shouting back and forth. She doesn't understand what's going on. And then someone comes up and takes her baby. And it's like,
what's going on?
What's going on? Am I going to see that baby? Am I going to see my child in a couple of minutes or, you know?
Or ever.
Yeah, or ever.
They went to 2nd and Market Street. You'll see in the film that the building is still there.
Yeah, it's a coffee shop.
It's a coffee shop.
I want you to try to describe to people who haven't yet seen the film sort of what life was like, Oliver, for enslaved people in Philadelphia at that time, before Philadelphia, I guess, became Philadelphia.
Yeah. I think the first thing that surprised me was how closely people lived together. You know, I grew up in a segregated society. I didn't see white people. I thought we were all separated. But in a city like Philadelphia, where everything was so close together, you have free people, you have people who would be called undocumented today, who are out from slavery trying to work their way north. You have Irish immigrants, you have Spanish, you have indigenous people.
Chinese sailors.
Chinese sailors. Mm-hmm. And they're all living together. And that was a revelation for me, because I still had the vision that we were all sort of like South Carolina or Virginia, mm-hmm. where I'm from.
Yeah.
Blacks and whites, we lived in the farm, they lived in the house. So everything was so cosmopolitan. And what happened is, when you have all this closeness, black people are hearing everything. They're hearing stories about freedom. They're hearing stories about independence. They're hearing stories about battles.
They were ripped away from their families, yes. They were kidnapped. They were trafficked across the Atlantic Ocean. But they were resilient and made the best of the situation that they found themselves in.
10% of all sailors were black. They were called blackjacks. So they were the network connecting all these black communities, because they'd go to Jamaica and they'd get stuff. When they arrived in Philadelphia, they'd go right down to Mother Bethel in that community, and people would say, what's happening? And they would share this information. So what we are trying to portray is the high level of interaction and communication that came together that informed these black folks that they should fight for the same rights of citizenship as white people were getting in this country. Those of us studying early America, most of us, at least I was, very shocked, because most of the writing where black people were sermons. And I came up in the 60s. We didn't want to read sermons. We mm-hmm. wanted to read, you know, political tracts. And Tara Bynum, who is one of the scholars, has gone through these sermons and actually translated what they really meant from the time they were in, thee and thou, and it's difficult to read.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All
just
right,
because
for
of
us.
The language differences.
Language
yeah.
difference. She went in it, an expert in the language, and then she began to extract what the real meaning was underneath of this language. They used a lot of stories from the Old Testament
yeah.
to talk about freedom. But they had to couch it in very thankful ways, because all the printers were white. A printer would read something and say, I'm not going to print that.
That was Oliver St. Clair Franklin, creator and co-executive producer of the new film Becoming American, Philadelphia's Story. It premieres tonight at 8 on WHYY.
Yes, we are listening back to my conversation with Oliver and Annie Connolly, an executive producer from Bear House Media, the film production company which made the documentary. On the other side of this break, we'll look at the time when yellow fever made its way to Philadelphia and how the black community rose to meet the needs of the city. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. If you're just tuning in, there's a new film premiering on WHYY tonight called Becoming American, Philadelphia's Story. It focuses on enslaved and free black communities here during the Revolution and highlights their many contributions to American independence.
Recently, I sat down with the producer's creator, Oliver St. Clair Franklin, and Bear House Media's Annie Connolly, to talk more about the stories they uncovered. To paint the truest possible picture of a diverse, complicated Philadelphia, the filmmakers go back to the early days of settlers in Pennsylvania.
We also start with the Native Americans, with the Lenape story of the walking purchase, where there's a big land steal. And I'm not going to spoil it for viewers, but it's jaw-dropping, right? I didn't know that. That kind of set up that this otherness was there from the very start, and the sort of Quaker mission, because it was a Quaker city, mm-hmm. was absolutely dominant, and we are going to impose our way of life on other people's, and everybody else has to fit into our system. And in fact, there was, I think one of the things that really struck me was the Quaker journey is really fascinating in this.
Because mm-hmm. William Penn was a Quaker.
That's right.
Who was gifted thousands and thousands of acres of land that eventually became Pennsylvania.
That's right.
And Philadelphia's nestled in there.
Yep.
And he had a point of view. There was a philosophy, a Quaker philosophy, Annie.
And some of it very noble, which is that because he was persecuted as a Quaker, that everybody should be able to practice their faith without persecution. And in fact, one of the things that struck me is you go to Mother Bethel and there's a synagogue right next door. And what strikes me going around the city is how many places of different worship there are here and the tolerance that is here of that. That started then. So not all of it is negative. Some of it is in the legacy is very positive. But other things that struck me was this, the idea that, and I'm not a Quaker expert, I'm just sort of couching what our scholars taught us, was that the Quakers, first of all, they went through their own paroxysms of should we own people or shouldn't we? And eventually they made it clear to their members, eventually, if you own enslaved people, then you are going to be out of our community. You know, you will not be welcome in our meeting house. And so everybody had to fall into line. But can you imagine the journey and how everybody disagreed with that? And some didn't. So that's the first thing that struck me. But even then, that when Quakers then were part of the Abolition Society, which they set up, that, you know, abolition was here before anywhere else. It was spearheaded here. So this is what I mean about the things that struck me were the contradictions, were the tussles. It wasn't just happening in the State House as they argued over the Declaration of Independence. It was happening in every walk of life. And a lot of it was about status, citizenship, belonging, who was who. If you were a woman, if you were poor, you could have been a poor white woman and you didn't have citizenship. That's the other thing that struck me. But what really struck me was that for people of colour and for people of African descent, the odds were stacked against them from the very, very, very beginning.
Yeah, and I want to go into this part of the conversation, Oliver, because this country was founded before race was an actual thing. People didn't say race, you know, before racism. And we see the contradiction, and I think this is something that you talk about openly through your own journey throughout the film. And on one hand, the founders said all men are created equal, and yet baked in to the founding of this country is this caste system that was being built. Can you talk about how you yourself, as the person taking this historical journey, sort of reconciled with that?
Well, it was more emotional than I anticipated when I started this journey. I thought I was just going to, like, you know, tell people this is here, this is there. And Annie and the crew said, you can't do that. You've got to give yourself to it. Once I gave myself to the project and my heart, I had my head, but once I gave my heart to the project, all of these contradictions that I had hidden just to be successful and function
in life,
yes. Right? I had a platform now to talk about those contradictions. And I think what happened is I grew up because being an adult, I discovered, is being able to hold two contradictory notions in your mind at the same time. So here we are talking about Thomas Jefferson, writer of the Declaration of Independence, who had five children with Sally Hemings, who was his slave.
Yeah.
And his wife's half-sister. I mean, it gets complicated. Here we are talking about Thomas Jefferson and him talking about liberty for all people, he having slaves, and he believing in his heart that it was evil to own slaves, and he did, but he also believed that white people would never accept black people as equals. And he try to get a scheme to, when you free black people, send them out of the country.
Yeah.
Because in his mind, the white supremacy DNA was so deep in his soul that he couldn't imagine us getting together as just people.
Yeah.
So that was hard. And then for me, I changed because we had a woman who was a Quaker, a black woman, and she was the only black Quaker down at the Quaker meeting house. Black people became Quakers, but most of them went to Mother Bethel after a couple of years. That quietness was not for them. But she stayed and she sat on the side 40 years. And when I heard about her 30 years ago, I thought, man, what is wrong with her? But when we were doing this film and I was in that room and I saw the bench she sat on, I realized she was resisting.
Yeah. Grace Bustle, who had to attend the meetings in a sit in a segregated space. And she went to church, went to the meetings in defiance, and she knew, her friends told her, don't even try.
Don't even think about it.
To fully participate.
Quakers in Philadelphia evolved from being a radical sect to being kind of moderates, but not innately assuming that people of color will be alongside them as fellow members of their own society. They'll be fellow members of a Philadelphian society, but it wouldn't mean they'd necessarily be co-equals in a kind of political social sense.
When we first went to the Arch Street Meeting House, and I said, but where did she sit?
And let me just say, this is why we're so good to have people that didn't know the history. I assumed that she sat with everybody else in the place until Annie asked the guide, where did she sit? And that opened a whole nother thing. Go ahead, Annie, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so the curator said, well, over there, it's separate. And that absolutely blew my mind.
Yep.
I sat thinking about that woman who worshipped there, who had her faith, whilst other black churches were springing up, and her husband, Robert Douglas, the barber, and he went elsewhere. But she kept staying there with her daughter. And I could not imagine what that was like. This is why our scholars were so brilliant. They were so broad-minded. They were so thinking about, let's teach history not in terms of binary values. Let's not just teach it as in, that is black and that is white. They are good. They are bad. Human beings aren't like that. They're complicated. We are complicated, three-dimensional people interacting and maneuvering in lots and lots of different spheres and levels, some of which is public, some of which is private, some of which is family. And she said to me, what you've got to remember is for Grace Bustle, yes, she was in there and she was separate and she was always other. But when she walked out, she had a family. She had a business. She was an educator. She had a zillion plates that she was spinning. Don't think that this was the only thing in her life.
Yeah.
You know, this is a woman who juggled and did so many other magnificent things,
yeah,
and was a leader in her free black community. This is a woman absolutely out there as an entrepreneur and more besides. So don't think that this was the thing that preoccupied her entire life.
This was just one thing.
This was one aspect of a mature, independent thinking, educated,
yeah,
black woman. I love that. And that's what we mean by, you turn something around, whether it's a document, an archive, a person. You could say the same about, you've just said it, you've just said it about Jefferson. You could say the same about lots of characters,
yeah,
that we know their names of or we don't know their names of. And you turn it around and you keep turning it around, you keep looking at it like a sort of round jigsaw, and you're adding the pieces, but you've got to keep adding the pieces so you get the whole person. And you keep turning it around,
yeah, yeah,
and otherwise we're missing the pieces. And that's no different from the purpose of this film. This, we cannot do the whole founding era, no one has, but there's so many,
yeah,
things for the 250th, but this is one aspect of it. And Oliver wanted to commission something that was the untold, more hidden,
yeah,
quieter side, and that's what we tried to,
yeah,
do.
I know that the film in your mind was three parts, and I mean, one of the parts was black participation and resistance at the same time. And I think one thing that stood out to me is that black people were not just, you know, observers to the revolution.
Absolutely.
They
not.
Were participants.
Absolutely.
In what was happening. And I know people have heard of James Fortin and the Fortin family, and their participation. I mean, he was there when the Declaration of Independence was read, but there was also some little known folks like Cyrus Bastille.
Yeah, Cyrus, he was interesting. He was a child of a white Scottish master and black enslaved woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a child, he was called a mulatto or, you know, colored. And the father decided to apprentice him to a baker. I mean, and rightly so. I mean, he wanted to look out for his child. And he became apprenticed to a baker. He did very well, and he decided to buy his freedom. So from the money he made working for the baker, he saved and saved, and he bought his freedom. Remember, we were property. Everybody had a price. And you could get free, like Richard Allen and Absalom Jones, if you could save your money and buy your freedom. So he saved his money, bought his freedom, had a wonderful bakery shop down in Old City, and he supplied the bread to George Washington at Valley Forge. When they were all starving, mainly what they had to eat was bread. And that was provided by this guy and his whole team. George Washington was so pleased that they say he gave him, and he paid him for the bread, of course. I mean, the man is a businessman.
Mm-hmm.
But he also gave him a gold coin to thank him. Now, you don't read about him. Anyway.
No, I had never heard that. I had never, never heard that story. And we've been doing a lot of interviews and talks around the different battles that had been going on during the Revolution. I never heard that story. You know, there were so many moments, I think, that stood out to me. And one that I think set the foundation for today was the rise of the Black church. As, you know, a place of empowerment for Black people, also political power for Black people. You know, Annie, if you could talk about that a little bit, because we actually have a historic relic right here with Mother Bethel AME Church.
I mean, I haven't answered your question earlier fully where you said, what did I learn? Well, one of the things was we did lots of brilliant things like Chris's Jazz Club and listening to music that was rearranged and played from Francis Johnson, the Odunde, loved that. But actually, the Mother Bethel service that we were invited in to film, it wasn't set up, it was their Sunday service. I'm from a Church of England background, you know, which is not as strict as Catholic, but it's very much, you know, stand, kneel, sing, you know, do what you're told. It's reflective, it's quiet, it's contemplative, but it's a sort of more traditional, quiet church setting in England. And I went into that church. I loved it. There was so much energy. It was vibrant. It was brilliant. I mean, the light that shone through those windows, and I love stained glass windows, but the history of that site, which we had researched, which we'd looked in the archives at, Reverend Carolyn Caverness was enormously welcoming. The whole congregation just let our crew in, and we were wandering everywhere. But what I loved about it was this, and you get that sense today still, this sense of serving God and a community and faith. But that is a deep-rooted faith in that place.
There's nowhere a place on earth like Mother Bethel. Sits on the oldest parcel of land continuously owned by African Americans, just not in Philadelphia, but in the whole United States of America.
That place is special. But what I loved about it was that it was such a different, as a Black church, was a different experience for me that I've ever had. And I was like, wow, why aren't my services like this? They're so much more fun. They're so much more vibrant. The singing is so, everyone's up, everyone's dancing, everyone's laughing. And it was wild, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And you were sort of on this wave. And I wonder if that, when we think about the early Black churches, it would have been there. And Reverend Carolyn Caverness said to us in her interview, Monday to Saturday, this was not their reality. And here they could be themselves. So it was for education. It was for politicking. It was for making, I'm sure there was business conversations going on. I'm sure there was family. I'm sure there was sadness, celebration, joy, people falling in love, you know, whatever, children running around. And I think that to be in a space where no one else saw you must have been incredible and against the grain of what else was happening in the country.
And one of the things I think that stood out to me was, you know, it was that seventh day, you know, at church, you could be the leader. At church, you could be something different than you were in a world where you were at the bottom of the caste system, so to speak. And it sort of changed the game. And Oliver, I would love for you to tell a bit of the story about the yellow fever and how the free black community, the enslaved black community came together to help the city.
The yellow fever was the first big epidemic, pandemic, really, to hit Philadelphia. It was our COVID on steroids, so to speak.
Post-founding, early days.
Early. And what had happened was no one knew what caused the yellow fever, so there weren't scientists telling it. But people were dying. They get blisters, and they were dying everywhere. And white people were leaving the city. They were going up. They were going to Germantown, which was a long ways away at that time, or they were going up
to Fairmount. They were going to Fairmount, weren't they?
And Fairmount and these places that was away. And the mayor of the city called the black leaders together and said, I really need you all to come together to help us bury the dying, look after the sick. And the black community wanted to be respected as citizens. And this was their opportunity to show their citizenship. And they came out and they looked after people. They buried people. And at the end of it, a guy named Curry wrote a book about it and said they were stealing, that they did a terrible job. And Absalom Jones and Richard Allen wrote a very strong document, a narrative, saying this was not wrong, this was a lie, and just refuting everything this guy said, Carol.
And this was because you had this educated class of black people could be articulate fight back. As we get ready to end, the title Becoming American, I mean, what are you hoping that people take from hearing all these distinct stories about black participation, black resistance, and the black quest for freedom, right? And black joy, right? Because all of that is sort of mixed in here. What are you both hoping people take, and what conversations do you hope that the community has around the 250?
I'll let you go first.
So I'm talking about this as a independent filmmaker who is not from this country and who made a history documentary, but understands that there is inevitably going to be political discussion around it. But for me, Becoming American, the reason we chose that title is it the whole narrative, the whole purpose of this was the question of how did you become American? When did you become accepted? When did you become a citizen? And that didn't start happening until after Reconstruction, and many would argue that is still happening, and to many different people of different creeds and colors today. That whole question of wanting to be belonging and participating and being there and part of a system that didn't accept you. And what we're talking about here is equality and rights and freedom. So that whole enshrinement in the Declaration. So we start the conversation. We do not finish it. We are not lecturing. We are not telling people what to do. We hope we're balanced. We hope there's fairness in there. We hope there is truth in there. But what we're saying is, this is a question to everybody. This is the start of a conversation about who is American. Yeah. And that's really why it's an open-ended, go think, go debate, go look at it, and understand that this began then and is still there today for people.
I'm surprised by how contemporary the film is today. Who is an American? Who belongs in America? I'm also surprised that the retrenchment in civil rights in America today, that this group was a group where everything was against them. They didn't have laws protecting it. And yet they survived, they created, they stuck together.
And you're talking about black people in Philadelphia.
Black people. Yeah. They were self-reliant. And what the present moment says with the retrenchment of civil rights is that we've got to start getting that mindset back of self-reliance, depending on each other, trusting and loving each other more.
And that was Oliver St. Clair Franklin, creator and co-executive producer of Becoming American, Philadelphia Story, and Annie Connolly, executive producer from Bear House Media, the production company behind the film. WHYY TV 12 will air the global premiere of the documentary tonight at 8 o'clock. Don't miss it.
And now, it's time to reveal our studio to DJ of the Day song selection. Nope, it's not Springsteen. It's not Simon and Garfunkel. It's not Neil Diamond. But it is a cover of a classic. Al,
hit it.
That is This Land Is Your Land by Chicano Batman. The song was originally written, as you know, by Woody Guthrie in 1940 as a critical response to Irving Berlin's God Bless America. Chicano Batman is an East LA band from the Latin American diaspora, and they reinvented it for this version in 2017.
Very cool. Thank you so much to Rob A. for choosing that version and for being our DJ of the day. And a shout out to Kate in Coatesville for stumping for the original.
Shout out, Kate.
We like it when there's a little bit of a, you know, stump.
Stump.
Yeah, we love that.
Don't this make you want to stump, stump?
I love it, love it, love it. And of course, I also love our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Paige Murray Bessler. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager. From Studio 2 here at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We'll talk to you next week.